All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome to episode 53 of the SLS Cast. Yes, folks, we're going to do some math on you, bitches, because 53 is the only two-digit number that is reversed in hexadecimal. What did I just say? Hexadecimal. That's what I was trying to say. 53. It's the only two-digit number that is reversed in hexadecimal. Yeah. I'm Matt.
I'm going to do some math on you bitches. I haven't heard that since my second grade teacher said that to my class.
That's a pretty badass second grade teacher. Yeah. Who said, I'm going to do some math on you bitches.
Yeah, Miss Eldridge. She was a hoe. Or she was
right
fat.
On.
PH fat.
Well, I'm in the everything, comma, bitches, exclamation point, because I finally finished Breaking Bad.
Oh, you did you?
Yes. Yes. Oh. And it's so everything is just kind of science, bitch.
You know, yeah.
But that's okay.
Has your mind been blown?
It was cool because, well, I dare spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet? I don't know.
I don't know.
I'm going to offer, okay. So close your ears for the next 5 to 10 seconds here. I loved it because he won. I'm going to wait here. 5, 4, 3, 2. Okay. And thus ends the spoiler. I loved it. It was amazing. It ended the way it should have. Not the only way it could have. And I was damn happy the way with it that it ended. It really is one of the best series. It ended up being one of the best series in all of television. It took till the third season for it to really get cooking, pun intended.
Oh, are you inspired to create blue meth?
Or no. I would be inspired to create a hit fucking podcast, though. And if it takes blue meth to do that, I'm down.
I like how assured you are with this. It's like, you know, if we can make a profitable podcast by selling drugs to anybody, you know, I think that would be the most logical business decision.
I'm sure.
Point.
Whatever works. By the way, who the fuck are you?
Oh, I'm Tim.
There we go.
Oh, who am I?
Official.
Who am I?
We're in the books, baby. Episode 53, well underway. Well, tell us about your day, Tim. I mean, because even though I finally finished Breaking Bad, you have had a just spectacular day. That's pretty cool. I don't know how much you can talk about it, but I would love to hear, and I'm sure that all of our listener would love to hear.
Oh, we're pulling that Conan O'Brien day. Thing. Or is it Craig Ferguson, where he always comes out and says, oh, it's just pity claps. Sit down. You're not here for me. You're here for the free candy. But we don't have free candy to give. We just have pity discussions and pity stories.
It sounds like something that Conan would do, but definitely that is more of a Craig Ferguson delivery.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. But I got a job, but I got a job that doesn't pay. It's more for a title, which I'm totally fine with because it's in the industry, the film and television industry, and since moving out to LA, I've kind of had a rocky start with finding PA jobs and any job that I've been wanting to have. I know that you have to start at the bottom and kind of work your way up, and only the very lucky end up getting full-fledged writing deals or directing deals, you know, all that stuff. You have to start somewhere, and usually it's working for free, working on short films, working for different thesis projects, and I may
doing free podcasts for doing people
exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, so I'm just doing prop. I'm a prop master for a little thesis short, and I don't know if I should name the school or not, but it's a very prominent school, film school. And they have each thesis, they have like a pretty big budget. I mean, it's like $60,000, and it's a 17-page script. You know, it's eight days of shooting, 3 months, 6 to 3 months of like preparation beforehand. And I was just brought on like 2 months ago, 2 weeks ago.
This is really interesting, considering that our migrant episode was 14 pages.
Yes.
Of script. And that was about 3.5 weeks of prep work, mainly by you and me just making sure that, you know, the script flowed and whatever. But definitely, you know, we're going to say 95% Tim. And then, like, what, about 7 hours of us really collaborating together, trying to actually get the recording done, and then however much time you spent editing.
Yeah.
And that was all of, let's see, you know, about $20 a year for the hosting on the Media Fire. Where's our $60,000? That's what I want to know.
One day, we do it for you all, or you won,
you too,
or you too.
Yeah, TWO.
Not the band.
Exactly. Well, oh my gosh. Well, okay. So you are a prop master here.
Yes.
And I if I'm speaking too much out of turn, I apologize, and feel free to edit me out or, you know, bleep anything here. But your uncle,
I edit you out regardless. What are you talking
about?
You
do, don't you? It's a whole bunch of and welcome to. Hi, this is Tim talking to you for the rest of the show.
Yes.
No, but seriously, but your uncle is a prop master.
He is, yes.
And he has definitely worked on some really cool projects and some TV shows and whatever, and, mm-hmm. and we definitely will leave that for anyone who wants to figure it out can figure it out. But is there anything that he has been able to impart to you? Is there any way to kind of do that in the world of prop mastery? Or is it really just kind of they give you the list, you procure said list, and then you're kind of just in charge of keeping track of props and what they're for and continuity and stuff?
Well, because this is a thesis project, it's a lot of, like, there's a couple professional people, like, there's this one lady who's the production coordinator, and she, of the art department, and so she's unionized. She actually worked with my uncle in the past, and I've met her before. And, but she's kind of like in charge of people that are not union, people that go to this school that's doing this project. And so it's a bunch of like union people that have had some professional experience working with, or sometimes clashing with, people with no experience that have just gone to school and are working on this. So it's been a lot of like, hey, Tim, you do this. Oh, hey, you help this department. You do this. You take on this big load. So this really isn't a good representation of what a prop master does, because it's all like working with set dressing, helping costumes out, helping doing special effects stuff because there's not a special effects person. So it's kind of like a big jumble, a big gumbo pot a big Watergate salad of a position this time around. But normally, you know, a prop person...
I understood that reference.
Yeah, exactly. A prop master is in charge of everything that an actor touches or picks up or uses, like cell phones, glasses, rings, swords, weapons, you know, stuff like that. So what's cool about it, and what I learned from my uncle, is that he's worked on... shows and movies that take place in Vietnam, and or samurai movies or TV shows where he's had to build these swords and design these really cool like fantasy props and stuff. So he's got to do like a lot of really cool things, and I like it because it's artistic. You know, you get to develop stuff and create something, and you actually see it on the screen, which is kind of neat. So I mean, if I enjoy doing it, but I really enjoy directing and writing. But, you know, props is a good alternative, I think. And, you know, the good thing about writing is that you can always write, you know, no matter what job you have. So it's
well,
been fun.
Well, that's awesome, and this is really cool because I think this is kind of a really cool side to the show that, as a bonus to talking about movies and stuff, you actually get to kind of give the world an inside view on things that go on. But I've always kind of wondered, okay, if that is what the prop master is responsible for, everything that they have to touch, and oftentimes they get to create certain props or work with art direction in terms of being able to develop props and things of that nature, where do you fit in, or does the prop master per se fit into the world of continuity? Because I know they have continuity experts and things of that nature now.
Yeah.
Does the prop master directly work with a continuity expert, or are they part of that continuity team?
Well, the good thing about the prop masters is that prop masters, props have like their own team of people. They have their assistants. So usually in the unionized professional world of movies and TV, The prop master is hardly ever on set. They just are out there buying the material, designing the props, finding the props, and it's his assistants and his PAs that are on set and actually working with the actors, dressing the actors, getting the props ready for them. And they're the ones that usually watch out for continuity because they are right there on set. Whereas like the prop master will just kind of pop in, make sure everything looks good, talk to the director. The prop master is the one that goes to the meetings, takes the notes, does all that stuff. So, so it's usually the PAs and the assistants and stuff that kind of mess with all that sort of thing.
Okay, and then what about, okay, now you have referred a few times to the union.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are various unions, you know, Screen Actors Guild, and et cetera. And not to definitely underlie their importance, especially when it comes to probably the grips side and the best boy side and that area. But how does the union fit in into something that's a thesis project for a school? Would it not?
No, it doesn't fit in at all. Yeah.
Okay, but yet they still have to have union participation or union oversight?
They try to look for non-union people, and it's all people donating their time. Nobody's getting paid. At least to my
So that doesn't affect a union, because I know, having watched a few documentaries where they with like extras and people in that field on professional shoots, they have to have a minimum number.
Right.
Of
hours,
hours and or union staff that are involved in a project before they can look to outside casting,
right,
or outside hiring. So that's not an issue in this particular.
Yeah, no. I mean, to my knowledge, it's because they're a school, and you can. I mean, there are non-union shows. I mean, look at 90210 for an example. It started off
the previous one. Okay.
It started off as a non-union show, and then it became a union show. And surprisingly, a number of shows, that's how they started off as non-union. And it's through that many people become unionized when the show gets picked up, or when the show becomes union, or whatever. And you see that a lot, like, outside of California, and in different cities and different states. And that's why you see, like, the Texas Film Commission, and the Georgia State Film Commission, and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's ways to get around the laws. It's just that if you have a non-union movie, you know, like an indie movie that has non-union people in it, then you cannot hire union people. Because if you hire union people, qualifications and the laws and all that stuff, like you were talking about, just completely change and screw things up. They have to be paid a certain amount. They have to follow rules and stuff, so... You know, sometimes it's just easier and more or less costly to do a non-union project. But yeah, this is a school, so I think with the school they can get union people, non-union people. The makeup guy, he's unionized, but he's just doing this to help out. So it's kind of like donating their time for the sake of helping people out, helping people grow in the industry, helping people get associated with the industry. And it's a great way to meet people and to get contacts and whatnot. So
you know, it's a cool experience. So anybody out there in out here in California or, you know, elsewhere, look into stuff like that. Look on Mandy.com or Craigslist or Entertainment Careers or anything like that, because they, I mean, there are postings all the time for different film schools or these little bitty out right out of college, right out of film school, little short films that people are looking for people to be part of a crew, work for free usually, but you know, you might get a pizza or two out of it at least. So
sweet. Well, that's my department.
The pizza department?
Yeah, Papa John's, man. I got the pizza covered. My little small contribution to Hollywood, if it was at all possible. All right, well, awesome. Okay, well, see, I think this kind of stuff is really kick-ass, and I like to learn about it anyway. But I suppose it is time that we move on to...
The News!
Yes, for the second week in a row, Tim's fucking slacking off. I don't want to hear about his 20-hour days and having to get on set at 4 o'clock in the morning. He hasn't done shit when he's been doing anything else. So, we have three pieces of news for you this week.
If this says anything, I've tried to watch Red Dawn for the past 5 nights, and I have yet to complete the movie.
You're not missing much, bro. Don't worry about it. Did you watch the original one back in, like, 83?
Well, I didn't watch it back in 83. I watched it maybe
from 83.
Maybe like 2 years ago.
You've seen that one, right?
Yeah, I've seen that one.
That's the better one. Yeah. Just know that's the better one and you're in good shape. We'll get there. We'll get there eventually. All right, so I know I keep pushing back this piece on the Humane Society. Just go to Variety if you really want to check it out. I promise, I swear that I will go in depth into this piece someday. But at this point, it's definitely not going to be until January. So I'm just going to do these three little pieces of Spitfire news for you. And I will get to the Humane Society piece and when we have a little bit more time to talk about it. But at this rate, it looks like it's not shaping up until January.
Or maybe next week.
It might be next week. Yeah. It might be. But I've said that for the last 3 weeks in a row, and I just don't want to keep saying it'll be next week. So maybe this time, if I under-promise and over-deliver, we'll be in better shape.
But we'll be in the same room next week, so it might be...
This is true. Yes, because Tim is coming to Houston. He's coming home for Christmas. Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. Anyway, all right, so here we go.
Royalty check made out from Matt.
Actually, as long as you're under 2 bars, you're good. Or, I'm sorry, 14 measures, and that's fine. So I didn't. Yeah. Okay. It was a parody. I'm making fun of that song because I said so. All right, there we go. from Variety.com, courtesy of Justin Kroll. Gal Gadot to play Wonder Woman in Batman vs. Superman. Of course, Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill are set to star. And it is official. Gal Gadot will play Wonder Woman in the untitled...
Who the hell is Gal Gadot?
She's the chick playing Wonder Woman. I just said that.
Well, I mean... Apart from
I
from
don't
cast
know.
Woman,
am I supposed? I'm supposed.
Was she like?
Was
Grey's
I supposed
Anatomy
to do? Wait, was I supposed to do due diligence on this? My bad. Let me pull up some Gal Gadot right quick for you.
Let me pull
right,
some
so
Gal
here,
Gadot.
Yeah, it's.
Oh,
Gal
that
Gadot.
Sounds like
all
a,
right.
A disease of some sort.
No.
Get
it
that
sounds
Gal
like
Gadot
a wine.
Around.
It sounds like a wine, or perhaps a character from The Hobbit, upcoming. All right, Gal Gadot is an Israeli actress and fashion model. She was born in 1985. She's 28 years old. And she does have a spouse and a child.
A spouse?
Her most famous roles... Her most famous roles were in the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, classics.
She, I believe, was the love interest for... who just died? Paul Walker. And she reprised the role in Fast 5 and was in Fast 6.
Bilbo, you must speak to Gal Gadot.
Yeah, Gal Gadot Baggins. All right. Any other grades?
Oh.
Oh, my gosh.
You
have
mean
some more wild turkey,
vagina,
Matt.
I think Gal Gadot? I will.
Wait, I don't know. I'm having more wild turkey and cocaine. What?
Wild turkey and cocaine?
No. I said wild turkey and coke.
Cane.
Hang, comma, space, hang on.
Well, damn, Walt White.
Yeah. Well, it's the 101. My particular favorite whiskey is Wild Turkey 101. I do not subscribe to the fact that there is an 81 proof Wild Turkey. I choose to believe that it does not exist. And so I only get Wild Turkey 101. And as I have been celebrating for the last 3 hours now that I have maintained my 4.0 in school, it's been a solo celebration, which I guess in its own way is kind of fucking sad. I'm still enjoying myself.
Masturbatory celebration.
That's later.
Ew. What if John Goodman played Walt White in Breaking Bad?
Hang on, I'm trying to swallow the drink. With your ew. Oh my god. I think that the show would not have lasted as long.
Why is
I'm not
that?
Gonna lie. No slam against John Goodman per se. He just simply does not convey. He either the way I look at John Goodman and how he behaves, and I know this is really important to the story of Gal Gadot Baggins and her role as Wonder Woman.
Oh yeah.
Which, we're still there, don't worry.
He
has a way that he is able to portray a role, and he's very, very good at portraying a role. But his role is usually a non-dynamic role. And so the way he comes across is either over the top, very serious, understated, quite funny, rather dramatic. And there's nothing wrong with it. He's very, very good. He's had such a long-lasting career in Hollywood because he's able to pull off such varied roles. And he is a really good actor. The thing is that the vast majority of roles, and I have not seen everything he's ever played, but the vast majority of roles that I have seen have always been, and I don't mean this in a bad way, so I apologize if it comes off as such, because it is not what I intend. But his roles seem, more often than not, one-dimensional, in that whatever role he plays comes across as that style from start to finish. Walter White, the role of Walter White, was truly dynamic. And not only was it truly dynamic, and for those in who may not understand dynamic, a dynamic role, especially from literature that also translates into film, is a role that changes over time, either over the course of a series or the course of a film, over the course of an episode. That is a dynamic character, someone who starts in one place and ends in a completely different place. Class time is over. Thus concludes lecture 784 in the series. Walter White is a truly dynamic character. And it's interesting because through the flashbacks at the beginning of the series, you see he's actually a dynamic character, not once, but twice. He started somewhere, ended where he begins at the beginning of the series, and then transforms again by the end of the series. That's not something I could see John Goodman pulling off. I simply don't see it that. That is not to slam his ability or the fact that I love him as an actor, because I think he's a fantastic fucking actor. I just don't know that he would be able to do something like that.
I agree. I was just trying to make you choke on your wild turkey and cocaine.
Well, it was the ooh that got me, not the John Goodman.
Oh.
things got serious when John Goodman was placed on the table.
That's right, dude. Now, John Goodman, as far as I'm concerned, is a god.
So what's going on with Gal Gadot?
All right, so Gal Gadot Baggins.
Harry what?
It's a disorder. I have Harry Gal Gadot. Good God, I apologize, Gal Gadot, if you ever hear this.
Oh my God. It's like something you get after you lick an armpit or something. Oh God, I got Gal Gadot on my tongue.
This is worse than Nibbles McJovovich, I swear to God. All right, so
I gotta trim my Gal Gadot.
Gal Gadot will play Wonder Woman in the untitled Batman vs. Superman movie. Of course, as we already know, Henry Cavill and Ben Affleck are set to star with Zack Snyder directing. And here's all I wanted to pull out of this here for you, folks. Quote, Wonder Woman is arguably one of the most powerful female characters of all time and a fan favorite in the DC universe. Not only is Gal an amazing actress, but she also has that magical quality that makes her perfect for the role. We look forward to audiences discovering Gal in the first feature film incarnation of this beloved character. End quote, Snyder said. And this will definitely be a departure because most American audiences only know her from her work in Fast and Furious. And I'm interested to see how this plays out. The only thing that I'm worried about is that even though there are not a mass of A-list actors in this movie, I'm just a little bit worried about the Batman Returns aspect, mm-hmm. where they start throwing too many actors into the mix that are in major roles, and it just begins to get harder and harder to give everyone who needs it. Not because I'm an A-lister and I demand this. It has nothing to do with that. But as you start throwing more and more major characters, regardless of the star power behind them, but as you keep throwing more and more major characters into a movie, it starts to divide the story, and it divides the attention, and it gets harder and harder to keep that cohesive story going forward. And at first it's Superman, now it's Batman versus Superman, now we've got Wonder Woman in Batman versus Superman. And the problem is that as in terms of this particular aspect of the franchise, both Batman and Wonder Woman are now being introduced, and I'm just worried that it's going to start fracturing the picture and not making it as good as it could have been.
Right on.
Next up, picking up the pieces. This comes to us from Yahoo Movies, courtesy of Mariah Doty. Picking up the pieces, 7 actors who died before finishing their films. And this, of course, is in the wake of Paul Walker's tragic death. And they have actually halted production officially for Fast and Furious 7. They are, however, as I had previously reported, they are now officially trying. They've halted production, but in order to figure out a way to not just cheaply replicate the rest of the film just so they can make money off of Paul Walker, but they're actually trying to work his death into the film so that they can actually make a real go of it. So I thought that was cool. However, other actors who have died ahead of time. And it's both affected how a movie has come out and if ever. Number one on the list here was Marilyn Monroe in Something's Got to Give. With Monroe and a splashy nude pool scene that predates Christie Brinkley's In Vacation by a few decades, the comedy remains unfinished to this day. Monroe was initially fired from the film, then rehired. Her death in 1962 became the ultimate roadblock for the troubled film. Number two on this list is Brandon Lee with The Crow. For better or worse, Lee's death, which happened when a faulty stunt gun mortally wounded the actor, triggered fascination over the gothic action film, wherein he plays a murdered man who returns to life. Lee hadn't shot all his scenes when he died, and it looked like the film was a wash. Then Miramax stepped in, invested $8 million extra dollars, enabling the film's completion, 90s awesome soundtrack, and all. 3, River Phoenix, Dark Blood. Phoenix was not yet finished filming Dark Blood when he collapsed at a West Hollywood nightclub and couldn't be revived. It wouldn't be until this year, 2013, a full 20 years later, that the film would see the light of day on YouTube. Director George Sluzer posted the entire film on the online video site in several parts so Phoenix's fans could finally see the last of his work. Natalie Wood.
I didn't know that.
Rainstorm.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really kind of cool stuff. Number 4, Natalie Wood, Brainstorm. The Rebel Without a Cause actress died in 1981 during a production break for the sci-fi film Brainstorm. MGM stalled its release by 2 years. Once the film was put back on track, a body double was used for Wood's remaining scenes. And for those who don't recall Natalie Wood, thus being the season of Christmas and all that, just look at the original Miracle on 34th Street, and she's the little girl. That's Natalie Wood. And it's interesting because that Robert Wagner, who most of today's world would know as number 2 from the Austin Powers franchise, was heavily implicated in her death because of the drowning that had occurred. I also believe, and I'm not 100% on this, that Christopher Walken was on the boat when it occurred as well.
Yeah, he was.
Okay, so that's... and so there's a lot of stuff that goes on. They've actually, even as of as late as last year in 2012, they reopened the case courtesy of some testimony that had changed. This is something that kind of doesn't die, which I guess might be a poor choice of words, but it's worth looking into. There's a lot of conspiracy theories that go along with that. Number 5, Heath Ledger, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Ledger hadn't shot nearly enough of the 2009 Terry Gilliam film to make for a salvageable final product when he died from an accidental drug overdose at the age of 28. The director, known for his flair for the surreal, cast Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell to fill out the remainder of Ledger's part. Yes, 4 men, all in the same role. Which I thought was really kind of cool, because it allows people to see one of the last works of Heath Ledger, but at the same time, they don't try to capitalize on it. They just kind of let the character be and use it in a really fun way. And I thought that was really kind of cool. I think that more people ought to take a page out of that book. Not necessarily make everything surreal, but at least provide an interesting way to continue when the unthinkable occurs. Number 6, John Candy, Wagons East and Pocahontas. Candy had shot the majority of his scenes for Wagons East when he died of a heart attack in his trailer on the film set in Durango, Mexico. The comedic western rode on to a summer release that year. The same cannot be said for Candy's role in the Disney animated feature Pocahontas. His part as a turkey sidekick was cut from the final film. Finally, 7, Aaliyah, The Matrix Reloaded. She was a pop star on the rise and even had a role in a wildly popular sci-fi franchise when she died in a plane crash in 2001. Aaliyah had shot some scenes for the follow-up to The Matrix, but it apparently wasn't enough material and her role was recast to Nona Gay. And of course, everybody will probably remember her burst onto the movie scene in Romeo Must Die, and then of course her subsequent death, but the last film, of course, Queen of the Damned. And unfortunately, that was not such a great flick. Finally, for me in the news, we have a little fun ditty, courtesy of RolloandGrady.com.
Settle down, Casey Kasem. Tonight, a really fun ditty for Rowan and Gray.
Hang on. I can actually do this. Hang on. Okay. And tonight, here we have a Rollo and Grady really fun little thing from RolloandGrady.com. This year is about the Big Lebowski. That's right, folks. Former Stones manager Alan Klein owns the rights to this wonderful song called The Decade of the Dude and the song Dead Flowers. Burnett begged Klein to just come down and watch an early cut of Lebowski. It gets to the part where the dude says, "I hate the fucking Eagles, man." Klein, who had actually been someone who had not wanted to release his music to the Big Lebowski, stands up and says, "That's it, you can have the song." That's all I got.
Yeah, that's a good story. It's a classic.
It really is. Okay, so let me tell that story for real. All right, again, really and truly, this is Rollo and Grady. All right, so the Big Lebowski, assistant editor, Andy Green, okay? He is talking about how the Inside the Dude Stoner track. Basically, what happened was music supervisor T-Bone Burnett recounted his troubles in securing the rights to Townes Van Zandt's cover of the Rolling Stones' Dead Flowers. All right, so Alan Klein owned the rights to the song. He wanted $150,000 just to use the song in the movie. They didn't want to spend $150,000 for that one song. So Burnett begged Klein to just come down and watch an early cut of Lebowski. Quote, "It gets to the part where the dude says, 'I hate the fucking Eagles, man.' Klein stands up and says, 'That's it. You can have the song.' That was beautiful." End quote. I just think that's really cool when something so artistically amazing happens that someone does a complete 180 and then it allows an amazing movie to truly come together, which is what happened here with the soundtrack. And I just think it's really cool. I just wanted to make sure that people knew about that fun little bit of trivia. And that is the end of the news.
Matt's news.
Matt's news. Matt's news? What? Anyway.
And he wonders why I cut him out of every show.
Is that more whiskey and cocaine?
It really is, indeed. We are now moving along to
Three Square.
Okay, folks, our three squared for this week was, or is, autobiographies that we think should be made into movies. Now, we did end up cheating a little bit by throwing some biography action into it, but they're also a little bit of cheating, too, because not everything is strictly entertainment-related. And we're getting away from this on a technicality because when we came up with this topic, we never specifically said an entertainer. I know. Asterisks, read the fine print, etc., et al. As someone who may have had some trouble saying that last week might need to know. I'm not saying anything. Just in case. I'm just throwing that out there. It's in the ether now. We have some really excellent choices, and I'm very excited because I think this is a really kick-ass three squared. Tim, I have done a fuck ton of talking at this point, and I have a whole lot of wild turkey and cocaine I need to drink.
Okay.
So I'm going to let you go first.
Alrighty, so my three. Okay, the first one is a more of like memoirs by Larry L. King. Not the Larry King, not Suspenders L. King. This is Larry L. King, and he is best known for writing the play, or the musical, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which then spawned the movie with Burt Reynolds and Dolly Parton. And the book is The Whorehouse Papers, which came out sometime in the late 70s, I forget exactly when. And it just pretty much just recounts how he heard about the book, or he heard about the story breaking out in Texas. He's from Texas. He travels, he does research, and he wanted to do something with the story, and eventually he ended up writing a musical, which he doesn't like musicals. I mean, he's like the most conservative liberal guy. You know, he's weird around homosexuals. He's very crass, he's a drunk, raging alcoholic, he's an asshole, he speaks his mind. If he doesn't, like, get his way, he bitches and complains. He's the type of guy you can find at a bar just drinking with people and just telling stories and having a good time and not really wanting to put up with any bullshit. And this was the guy that wrote the hit musical Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And the story is just hilarious. Just some of the anecdotes he has. Like whenever he first meets Tommy Tune, the famed music or the famed Broadway performer Tommy Tune. Tommy Tune came and did the choreography for Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, and he made Tommy Tune cry because of how angry he was all the time. And it's just hysterical hearing his reactions, because he knows that he has a problem, but he just really doesn't care. And the guy started off with no money. I mean, the guy is just poor, you know, trying to, like, I mean, he pays his taxes, but he's just trying to get away from creditors and never answers his phone. And it's just, like, it's the perfect character to see either in a miniseries or on the big screen. And I can't think of anybody who could play him at this moment, but it's just a funny story. And, you know, it's obvious how it all turns out. And you realize later on that this is actually a pretty good guy. And that if it wasn't for the way he was, or his outlook, you know, like just his work ethic, we wouldn't have had this kind of movie. Let alone we wouldn't have had this kind of book. So I suggest for everyone to go out and buy this book. Actually, yeah, go out and buy this book, definitely. Because it is a great read. And I think you'd agree with me, it would just be a great movie to watch. It's The Whorehouse Papers by Larry L. King. Next up is Keith Richards' Life, which actually I do believe they are going to be making a movie or miniseries. Hopefully it's a miniseries, because it's a long-ass fucking book. And you cannot cover all this shit in 2.5 or 3 hours. But it's, I mean, right off the bat, the first story in the book is a classic. It's about him and, I think, Ronnie Wood. I'm trying to remember. It's been a couple years. But him and Ronnie Wood the Rolling Stones are on tour in the South. Him and Ron Wood are in their car, or in a car, and they're driving through Georgia or South Carolina. Or I don't remember, somewhere. Arkansas, maybe. And they get pulled over, and it turns out they have all of this, like, cocaine, pot, like, pills, all in the door of this car. So they get pulled over, the car gets impounded, they get sent to, they get put in jail, and they have to go to court the next day. And somehow, they were able to get let off so they can perform in a concert that night. And what's so funny is that what he mentions, and again, right off the bat, I mean, he remembers, the guy is in his 70s, he's done a lot of drugs, more drugs than he has women, I'm sure, more drugs than he has strung his guitar, maybe. Yeah, probably so. And he, you know, he's just always smoked, always drank. And yet he remembers all of these stories with such clarity. It's just fantastic to read. And just visualizing it, you know, it just seems like it would be just a fascinating movie to watch. Or a miniseries, again. And what's great is that just him talking about, like, how somewhere right now there is a car, and he's specific about what kind of car it was, is sitting at an impound yard somewhere, and there is, like, thousands of dollars of marijuana, of drugs, just inside of the car door. And he's like, oh, it would be so funny if maybe, like, if the car went up for sale or auction, and, like, a priest ended up buying it or something. You know, just, like, really funny stuff like that. And that's kind of, like, how most of the book is. Just excellent insight. Lastly, oh, you know what's really funny is that I thought of a couple other books. One of them is Craig Ferguson's book, but, you know, I'll save that for another entertainment biography, little three squared we do. But lastly is a really cool book that I read just within the past year. It's called The Journey to Ixlan, The Lessons of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda. And it was released in 1972, and this was Carlos Castaneda's third book about his schooling, of the schooling that he received from Don Juan. He is the shaman, I think it's the Iroquois shaman in New Mexico, I think. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's in Mexico. And this guy just goes to see him because he's told that Don Juan will, He will expand your mind. You know, you will find peace with yourself if you follow his lessons. And throughout the book, he talks about, like, every so often he'd go and meet him at different points of his life, and he would go through all these lessons where they would take these long walks into the desert for like 24 hours. And at some points he had to walk the desert, and like there are snakes, there are coyotes out there, like blindfolded. And it's just interesting how they intertwine humanism with spirituality. And what's great is that the guy, I believe he's an atheist, like he doesn't believe in spiritual stuff. I mean, he just did this on a whim. But by the end of the book, he leaves a changed man. And Carlos Castillo and Don Juan became good friends. I mean, like they were like father and son. I mean, he was his mentor in life. And what's great is that Carlos, throughout the book, goes on this journey to Ixalan. But it turns out that Ixalan is the position of being. You know, it's where you are in life. It's who you are within this universe. And you know, it's life is about finding yourself. And what's great about this book is that by the end of it, Carlos Castaneda has to choose. He has to decide for himself whether or not to leave his life to continue his journey to find inner peace, to find his inner true self, or to live his life of, oh, making money and stuff. Because, you know, Don Juan believes, well, if you want to find inner peace, you have to give up everything. And it's just a fascinating story. So, it would just be an awesome, again, TV miniseries or even a movie. It would be fantastic. Probably Johnny Depp can play Don Juan because he plays... I don't know, it just seems like a character he'd play. It wouldn't be good, because he'd just be stumbling around, effed up on peyote, probably. But who knows? Alright, so again, my three are The Whorehouse Papers by Larry L. King, Life by Keith Richards, and then finally, The Journey to Ixalan, The Lessons of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda.
Outstanding, sir. Outstanding. All right, my three are really wonderful and varied. First up, and they're in no particular order, but first up for me, Bob Hope's Don't Shoot, It's Only Me. This is a autobiography. He kind of recounts the comedic history of his life. He doesn't go into too much detail in this particular book about his growing up, per se, as he does about where he began in vaudeville, how he became a comedy legend. He actually hired writers. I know, imagine that, right? And then went on to the USO and just how he kind of became the man, the face of comedy for many generations. He is just a fantastic writer. I'm sure he had help with this, but even still, it's a fantastic read. He talks about how he would fold up his writer's paychecks into paper airplanes, and he would stand at the top of a circular staircase and throw them down to make them get it, because he figured that was the only way they were getting exercise, writing jokes for him all the time. He also goes into how he ended up establishing himself as a USO touring artist. And really interesting, weird historical facts. Like, from this book, I learned that Adolf Hitler's real name was Adolf Schickelgruber. I mean, who would really be afraid of that, right? These are just the kinds of things that are so...
Schickelgruber. Yes.
Schickelgruber. Mm. It's almost something like out of a Hansel and Gretel book, yeah. At any rate.
Or Gal Gadot.
Exactly. Gal Gadot Baggins.
Gal Gadot Schickelgruber.
Yeah. And as she's Jewish, I'm sure that that was not offensive at all. Anyway, he goes on to just kind of relate his career, and it's just such a fascinating read. And I just really think that it would make such an interesting movie, because the man lived. He was over 100 years old when he passed away, and to go from vaudeville through World War II, through USO, movies and then television and countless specials and meeting presidents. And, I mean, this would just be a fascinating life to see, and I really think that it would be something worth watching. Next up on my list is a kind of autobiographical biography. And this is Gracie by George Burns. And of course, this is a book about George Burns' life with Gracie Burns. And so that's where I get autobiographical biography, because while he does write about Gracie, it's his life with her. And he discusses their starts in vaudeville, how they started off where he was trying to be funny and he never was, but Gracie could get laughs, and so that's how they developed he became the straight man. And how they carried that act on from vaudeville through radio into TV, the movies, and they carried it on for years upon years. It talks about her life, their life together up through her death and even beyond, because it talks about the last chapter to deal with his life post Gracie's death and even his resurgence in the late 70s, early 80s that brought him back as a comedy icon in his own right. I really think this would be good because it doesn't just talk about all the good things and all the success. It talks about their problems. It talks about the things that he went through dealing with someone like her, not in a bad way, but just his own insecurities and how he reacted to the way things went and the business that they built together. And he's actually very honest. He actually discusses his infidelity, which is something that I had never seen anything like that. Someone that brutally honest about it. It's just an amazing book, and it's an amazing story, and it's a true love story. I really think that this is one of those things that would make just a fantastic movie. And I would love to see it. I think it would be just amazing. Finally, this is a movie. This is something that I would like to see a movie, but I really think this would definitely be in the realm of the HBO movie world. It's a step above Lifetime, I think, and deserves something that HBO could do. But for me, I would definitely have to say that Made in America by Sam Walton. And of course, if you don't know who Sam Walton is, this is not the guy that the Waltons was based on. No. This is Sam Walton, the guy who founded Walmart. And this is a guy who has just an incredible life story, who discusses everything from how he came into the business of being in retail, how he developed his merchandising skills, putting places like Dollar General on the map, and then deciding that he could do it better, and needing that creative control led him to found Walmart. And there are tons of interesting stories, even just in the development and building of that corporation. Things like, the reason why it's called Walmart is because they needed to save money, and that was the cheapest name they could come up with because it only had 7 letters, so the signs would be cheaper. Things like he needed to be able to scout new territory so that they could develop more stores and expand the company, so he fucking taught himself how to fly and then went about flying about and scouting new locations. It's just absolutely amazing to see how this guy built such a huge corporation and something that has taken over the world. And yet, he himself never changed. I don't know that things could happen like that anymore, but I do think that that's something that's worth making a movie about. So my choices, again, are Don't Shoot, It's Only Me by Bob Hope, Gracie by George Burns, and Made in America by Sam Walton. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is The Three Squared. Now, moving on to the movies. Yes, the movies. All right, we had 3 movies this week. The Iceman, 2012's version of Red Dawn and Out of the Furnace. What do you want to start with, sir?
I do need a review, Old Boy and Philomena, still.
Oh, dear God. And playing catch-up from last week is Tim with his reviews of Old Boy and Philomena. Ready, go.
I can do this really fast. Old Boy, 3 out of 5 stars. Surprisingly, I enjoyed. I guess it was kind of like Matt. Went into it with thinking that it was going to be horrific, but it was decent. It has some cool camera movements in it. But I thought that the movie was a little too much, like, up its own ass by the end of it, like, trying way too hard to have a crazy ending. And I think a lot of it is because of, I forget the actor's name, but the bad guy. Like, his way of talking and, like, the whole explanation of why he's doing all that. And I knew that it was going to be his actual daughter, but it just got a little too weird. It felt like it was trying to be weird for weird's sake. And I think what it was missing that the original does so well is the opening narration. The narration throughout the movie just provided this great fantastical element to it that made you, like, extend the belief, you know, in your mind. Like, you're able to accept that, you know what, okay, well, I know this isn't real or this could never really happen. But you know what? You know, I believe in these characters, so you can find enjoyment in it. And this movie really doesn't have it all that much. 3 out of 5 is a generous rating. And also, there was way too many CGI violence that, to me, obvious CGI, like people shooting themselves in the head and their brains flying out. It ruins a movie for me. I hate seeing CGI blood and CGI gore. I just absolutely, especially a movie like this, where the movie isn't all about the violence, but whenever somebody gets shot or when violence happens, it's very prominent. And when most of it's CGI, you know, it takes away from any level ground or any firm ground that the movie has developed, if any. So 3 out of 5. Philomena is a great movie, a great story. It doesn't have the wit like a lot of British comedies have that, you know, that I kind of prefer, but it's still, the story itself is so good, and the performances are excellent. Judi Dench gives one of her finest performances. Steve Coogan, it's great seeing Steve Coogan, not in a dickish role. He actually plays a really good guy that's on the teetering on his belief system, and this journey that he goes on to help this woman find her son, which when she was in the nunnery or in a convent years ago, she ended up having sex and getting pregnant by this guy, and that was frowned upon in this convent. So the nunnery punished her by sending her in basically the church sweatshops, and they took her kid and sold her to an American family. And that's apparently what they did, and it turns out that this movie is based on a true story. So even that, you know, that adds something, you know, some, like, crazy interest into this movie. And, you know, I just liked it. It had interesting characters, but it misses something. But to me, it's still a 4 out of 5 star movie. And it tries a little too hard at times to be funny, when sometimes the best British comedy, it just happens naturally. So, Old Boy, 3 out of 5. Philomena, 4 out of 5.
Right on. Okay, well then, where do you want to start, sir, with the movies for this week?
Let's go, how about The Iceman?
Okay, The Iceman, which is a 2012 American crime thriller film directed by Ariel Froman, and it's based on the life of notorious hitman Richard Kulkinski. Kulkinski played by Michael Shannon. We also have Winona Ryder, Chris Evans, and Ray Liotta who star in this film. For me, this movie is 2 out of 5 stars, and here's why. I know the real story of Richard Kulkinski, and this one barely scratches the surface of him. I watched the HBO specials on this guy years ago. I mean, they're out there. You can catch most of the stuff on YouTube now. And I watched it because of my morbid curiosity. I watched it when it first premiered on HBO way back when. And while Michael Shannon, Winona Ryder, Chris Evans, Ray Liotta, they do give really good performances. I find James Franco was also really cool in this particular one. But their performances cannot salvage a really poor story. And that's the problem, is that this story is just very poorly written. I'm not trying to take away from Roman as a director. I think that clearly, given the performances that are dealt, that he does do a good job of driving the performers to bring these characters to life. The problem is that he was involved in the screenplay in addition to producing it. He doesn't have a good story to work with. And the problem, and that's again the problem with Hollywood movies. They are not, you have such amazing source material. Why do you need to draw a story that's merely based on a life? You could just do his life from his interviews, from what he said happened. That is backed up by what happened in court and came out at trial. This is a man who got away with murder for decades. Not just because he was good at his job, and not just because he's a sociopath in his field, but because he figured out how to freeze bodies so that nothing could ever come of them. They would just be missing persons until their body would show up months or years later. They could have done it from the perspective of the HBO documentaries and then let the flashbacks come to life on their own. And this would have been a 5-star movie with the same actors. I mean, you don't have to change anything but the story. And done it based on the actual real life documentaries and then had have flashbacks of what he's relating to you come to life in these setups. The story is what kills it. This could have been so much better than what it was. Consequently, for me, the story, the performances are solid, don't get me wrong. They do the best with what they have. It's just a piss poor story, doesn't play out well. 2 stars for me. I did not like this movie.
Yeah, I didn't care for this one much either. I give it 2 to 2.5 out of... probably 2.5 out of 5 stars. I think that Michael Shannon kind of tries a little too hard in this character. And he's a really good actor. It's just, I think he's one that just tries too hard to be so different in a movie that it kind of takes away from the movie a little bit. I don't know. It could be only just me who thinks that. But I'm with Matt. I really don't know anything about this guy. I definitely want to look more into to how he really was. But there was definitely something wrong with the script, the flow of it. I thought that the movie really didn't pay a lot of attention between the contrast of his family man life and his ruthless killer life, when that's kind of what this movie was pretty much supposed to be about, apparently. And it just kind of focused on how weird he was and how weird all these other people were. And it touched a little, you know, it touched more than a little bit on his family side, but it was never enough to think like, oh, you know, this man was a loving father. Instead, it's like, this man was just a fucking creep, you know, like, is he more than a father to his kids? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it was missing something to where I really didn't care. I mean, there were aspects of the movie that I enjoyed. Some of the cinematography, technically, some of it was really neat. But again, it's just some of the acting was forced. Some of the scenarios were forced. The storyline was forced to where it was nothing fresh and new and entertaining. And, you know, I guess
you know, with if it comes down to where they just didn't follow the story, that they just made something up for the most part, then they definitely probably should have stayed with kind of like what Matt was saying. But I don't know. So I give it 2.5 out of 5. Take it or leave it.
Right on. All right, where do you want to go from here, sir?
Let's do Out of the Furnace.
All right, out of the Furnace. Let me just start 2.75 stars here. Not because this movie is, for me, just for me, not quite good, but definitely better than okay. And this movie for me is a complete exercise in taking 20 minutes to do something that could have been achieved in 5. Where, and yet, I want to try and give them credit because this movie takes place in a small town, in an old steel mill town. And you get that life happens more slowly in this town. And it's shot that way. There are the cinematography for this movie is truly breathtaking, I find. There are just wonderful shots, excellent plays on angles, light, showing true emotion, how people live, what their motivations really are. There are lots of things that this film does well. Where the problem becomes for me, and this is a film, I apologize, got a little bit ahead of myself here. It's the 2013 American thriller film. It's directed by Scott Cooper, and it does star Christian Bale, Woody Harrelson, Casey Affleck in a killer performance, Forest Whitaker, Willem Dafoe, Zoe Saldana, and Sam Shepard. This is a movie about a man who is trying to find out what happened to his brother, who is missing, presumed dead, killed, and how he takes care of his family. Again, this is a movie that takes place in a steel mill town. It's slow-moving life. It's a simple life. It's a simple film in that regard. The problem is that they go through so many steps to get to the point of the movie that they overlook the fact that there's not as much there to tell as they think that there is. For example, in order to build the setup of the movie for why Christian Bale's character needs to look for his brother, played by Casey Affleck, they take approximately 20 to 25 minutes to establish what Christian Bale does, how he gets separated from his girlfriend, why they spend time apart, years presumably apart, and then coming back to what he left behind due to basically a DUI incident, and then needing to look after his brother. The thing is that this is a case in point of something that took 20 minutes that they could have done in 5, where you could have had 2 to 3 very powerful emotional scenes that could have taken 2 minutes, maybe a minute, minute and a half, 2.5 minutes apiece to really just broker this story and bring the believability and drive it home. Instead, they go 20 minutes and have 2 or 3 scenes that are 30 to 45 seconds that are just gut-wrenching and very well written and spot-on acted, especially between Christian Bale and Zoe Saldana. They didn't need to do it that way. Because of the setup and because of the way that the film is shot, it takes too long. And you're often sitting there wondering, why does it need to take that long? And I want to give them credit based on the fact that it's trying to mimic life in this area, how they behave, the way that they go through life, and the things that people live and how simply it goes. But even wanting to give them that, everything, all the way from the build-up, from the setup to the build-up to the penultimate finale to the closing of the film, takes too long. And it seriously detracts because you find yourself, or for me, I found myself literally starting to wonder, man, how long is this going to take? And that ruins it. It just takes you out of it because you have such intensity and such amazing ways to play this that it didn't have to go that route. And so it really hurt the movie for me from that perspective. And it really does for me fall between okay and I liked it. It is worth checking out. And so for me, 2.75 stars on that.
I like the pacing of it. There was just something to me that, or for me, that it established this tone that whenever certain things happen in the movie, it made it more believable. It made it more accepting for me to accept it, I guess. Whereas if I think that if certain things took maybe a minute or 5 minutes to do, it would just seem rushed and a little forced. Because, like, if a lot of big things happen in this movie, and it's a lot of character decisions. Some of them, there's a lot of bad, really shitty decisions that are made. And there's a lot of, like, really high, intense, you know, like, life-altering changes that happen in this movie. And so, with the pacing, and with it being a little slower, I kind of think that each one of these big moments that happens, they're played differently throughout the movie. Sometimes they're played where the scene gets very tense. Sometimes it's a little bit more, I don't want to say blasé, but or maybe like heart-wrenching than the other times. Sometimes it might take like a repeated viewing to kind of catch, you know, to catch on to that emotional wavelength. I don't know. I'm starting to sound like a hippie person. You got to catch on that wavelength. That sun-moonlight ray to understand what Christian Bale is conveying. And I really like Christian Bale in this movie. I enjoyed watching this movie where, I mean, he played a really outstanding guy. He made a horrible decision. A horrible decision. But he made it a point to completely turn his life around. And then seeing that he would give up anything, that he would do anything for his son, or for his son, excuse me, for his brother, played by Casey Affleck, who is also a good guy, but not to the extent of his brother. And in a way, it's kind of like Christian Bale's character. In order for his character to have changed to become a better person, something horrible had to happen. And that involved the DUI thing that Matt was talking about. But Casey Affleck's character, he may not have that chance to change after he gets himself into a situation. And I think in a way, knowing that, I don't know, it just adds this vibe to this movie that I've never, or that I haven't really experienced in a movie before. And I don't know if I'm making any sense or not, but it was just like part of that experience. And I don't think this was a spectacular movie, but I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I thought I gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I mean, I guess that would be really good. I thought that, for one thing, what the hell was up with Forrest Whitaker's voice in the movie? It sounded like he was doing a Danny Glover impersonation throughout the entire movie. It was a little bit, that might have been the cause for that one full star, is because of his performance in this movie. It was insane. But beside that, excellent performances by Woody Harrelson. William Dafoe was even good. I mean, you just feel, other than Woody Harrelson, he plays an evil character. But William Dafoe, you know, again, he's a good guy, and he's looking out again. It's kind of like if you look at, you know, like Casey Affleck's character. He didn't listen to his brother. He didn't listen to to William Dafoe's character. He didn't listen to his father, and look what happens.
You know, it's kind of like an interesting life lesson in there. And again, you know, again, there were just some really good, effective moments in there. And it was all because of the pacing. So, you know, I'll just leave it at, I give it at 4 out of 5 stars.
Well, I guess that leaves us with 2012's Red Dawn, which is remake of Red Dawn from 1984. This is directed by Dan Bradley and stars Chris Hemsworth, Josh Peck, Josh Hutcherson, Adrian Palacki, Isabel Lucas, and Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Now, the thing is here is that this movie was pretty much destined for direct-to-DVD when Thor came out and just blew the reins off everything, and so they were like, oh, it's got Chris Hemsworth in it. Quick, put it out. They should have just gone back to keeping the plan the same.
Yeah.
The movie ostensibly follows the original film, but instead of Cold War aspects, they changed it to a Russian-backed North Korean front that tries to take over America. And
originally it was China, and they went back and completely did everything. Yeah,
exactly. This movie, I'm going to be nice and give it 2 stars. It's really not that good. I didn't hate it, but seriously, it barely reeks of 2 stars. I didn't like it. I wouldn't recommend it. If you get stuck watching it, you're not going to shoot yourself in the head. But even like women folk fans who are just going to drool over Chris Hemsworth will probably not like this movie. It's a bad story. The performances are more or less, I'm trying to find the right word here. The performances are wooden. There you go. Wooden. These are kids who think they can act and can't. But they're not, like, terrible. It's not like fake acting. It's not like porn acting or anything like that, where it's obviously bad acting. It's just they're completely one-dimensional characters who don't have any life or vibrancy. And again, see, this is why I didn't want to use one-dimensional for John Goodman, because you see how it can turn into something that you don't mean. Here I mean it. It's a bad story. It's completely done to be politically correct instead of be accurate and or true to life. And the characters are not believable, and it just doesn't hold the same sway as the original does. And this is a prime example of why you do not need to remake everything. 2 stars. What do you got, sir?
Yeah, 2, that's pretty generous. I don't know how I can really rate this movie, because I tried watching this movie every night for the past 5 nights, and I fall asleep. I've yet to finish this hour and a half movie. And I'm awake whenever I start watching. It's just like, for a good maybe 30 minutes, it's the same bullshit. Big action scene. Then they're in the woods. Big action scene in the woods. Big action scene in the woods. It's just the same shit. And it's usually like the same 2 or 3 people talking. Like Chris Hemsworth character just consoling somebody, warning somebody, you know, threatening somebody that if you do this, you're gonna die. You know, it was just the same fucking bullshit. And what's really pisses me off is that, okay, so it was China, and they got kind of became pussies and went in and CGI'd all the Chinese symbols and made it North Korea. Yet, whenever you see the flags, especially when the camera's moving and you see a patch on a shoulder, on a soldier, which could be on the shoulder of a soldier or a flag, take a look at that flag. You'll notice that it looks weird because it's been complete. It was China's flag, not North Korea. And it's just really obvious that they went back and redid shit, because there's stuff in there that, like, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, that is the last thing I remember from the entire movie, is Jeffrey Dean Morgan. That is it. And, you know, there's just really shitty jokes. The movie's just really shitty. There's a couple good, really neat little action scenarios, but it goes by so fast that it's really not worth mentioning whatsoever. So I gave this movie 1 star because I don't know why. Maybe it's because I really haven't finished it, that I still have like 15 or 20 minutes. But I'll give it 1 star. It's just don't.
Well, that's fine.
Don't
watch it. That takes care of it, because I felt I was being generous, and you may not be thinking you're giving enough. So that averages to 1.5 star between the two of us. I'm fine with that.
Okay, there you go. The SLS cast rating is 1.5.
1.5 stars. There you go. That's the average. Yeah. All right. Well, that's going to take care of the show. We're coming into the end of the year. And you know what? We like to have time with our family as well. And so Tim is going to be in town next week. We are going to have a stunted episode for next week due to the fact that we like to have time with our family. And you know what? Well, maybe we just want to get drunk together as well, Tim and I. So we'll see how that turns out. But
not well.
Long and the short of it, we're only going to be covering one movie next week. We will, however, have an end of the year episode in terms of what our favorite movies for this past year have been for 2013, and then of course a beginning of the year episode that's going to be covering what we're most looking forward to for 2014. As a result, we will have a very stunted news. We won't have any middle of the road segment like Three Squared or Discussion Masterpiece or I'm the Only One Who Liked It or anything like that. The movie is more or less going to be a surprise, because we're thinking that it might be Anchorman, but it might also be The Room, but it might also be Santa Claus versus the Martians. It might also be Plan 9 versus Plan 9 from Outer Space. We're not quite sure. So just tune in next week and be surprised. It might be a movie that you've seen. It might be a movie that you haven't. And it might be a MST3K style live fest. We don't know. That's the beauty of next week. But until then, I think it's time for the spiel. Am I correct, sir?
Spiel on.
Very good, then. All right, so the music you've been listening to, as always, is provided to us by music partners Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace. As for us, of course, we're still the SLS cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. Of course, you can also go to facebook.com and search us there, the SLS Cast. You can even follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. And of course, as always, subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next time, this is Matt saying that thanks to Will Rogers, I get to say this. I'm not a real movie star. I've still got the same wife I started out with 28 years ago.
Matt, you're drunk. Good night. Or goodbye. Whiskey and cocaine.
Peace out, people.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.